Hey everybody, my name is Sarah Krieger. I'm an emergency physician and intensivist at UCLA, and this is the ICU EDU podcast. Today we are going to talk about a do thinking case, case number two. And this case is going to deal with complicated AFib. And I chose this case because this has been one of a number of cases recently that I've either had or heard about that have forced me to reframe or further reframe my thinking about AFib with RVR in this sick patient. Because the way that I had been thinking about AFib with RVR, and I think the way a lot of you probably think about AFib with RVR, is that usually when I see a patient with AFib with RVR, I kind of regard the AFib with RVR as, by default almost, the patient's primary cause of instability. But increasingly, in a lot of sick patients, I've been forced to transition to thinking about it maybe sometimes more as a marker of physiologic stress, thinking about it more like a sinus tachycardia. Because when a patient comes in with sinus tachycardia, especially if it's a sick patient, we don't perseverate on treating that sinus tachycardia. We're like, why are they tachycardic? And that's a marker of physiologic stress. And we don't give them a beta blocker or try and cardiovert the sinus tachycardia. We ask ourselves, are they volume down? Are they septic? Are they in shock? Are they anxious? What's going on? What kind of physiologic stress is causing that sinus tachycardia? How do I fix the underlying physiologic stress rather than dealing directly with the sinus tachycardia itself? With AFib, it's reasonable that our initial focus tends to be on directly correcting that rate and or rhythm through either drugs or electricity. But that only actually makes sense in cases where AFib, whether the rate or rhythm, is truly the primary problem. Now, it's certainly true that sick hearts, sick patients, don't tend to tolerate either the rate or the rhythm of AFib very well. But I think it's also true that sick hearts and sick patients may be more likely to go into AFib as a physiologic stress response as opposed to just sinus tachycardia compared to a healthy heart. And insofar as you believe that AFib with RVR in your patient at this moment may be more reflective of, in fact, a stress response than the primary thing causing their instability, it really changes the way you think about the patient. So let me talk through a particular case where this became very relevant. So this was a case a former resident of mine who's currently working at a critical access hospital called me about. And it's just her and a hospitalist. She doesn't have an in-house intensivist or cardiologist, so it's just her, and she had to figure out how to deal with this case. So this is the case she told me about. It was a 57-year-old female with a history of known pretty severe pulmonary hypertension, who came in with, as far as anybody knew, new onset AFib with RVR in the 160s. Now, this patient had a sort of borderline pressure. It wasn't low enough that you're like, oh, hypotensive, quote, unstable AFib, but it wasn't perfect. You know, it was like 90s to 100s over 50s. And her question to me is, in this patient with bad pulmonary hypertension, who, you know, seemed volume overloaded, looked really sick, was super tachypneic, and presumed new onset AFib with RVR with a rate in the 160s and this sort of okay kind of blood pressure, what is your best antiarrhythmic of choice? The kicker? The patient also has an acute renal failure and her presenting potassium is 7. She's still making good urine, but she definitely has a K of 7. So, that means that amio is out. Because when I was first sort of hearing about this case and I just heard this first part, I was like, oh, great, I would probably go to amio. And then she was like, but the K is 7. And I was like, oh, never mind, just kidding. And that also probably means with this acute renal failure, now is probably not the cleverest moment to start some DIG either. In addition, she was understandably nervous about cardioverting this patient because, you know, the patient was on the one hand totally awake, but she was in severe distress. She couldn't lie flat without desaturating. And between that and the not totally ideal blood pressure, she was very reasonably worried about sedating her. In addition, she didn't know how long this patient had been in AFib. They weren't anticoagulated. And to me, you know, even aside from the how long have they been in AFib anticoagulation concern, which, you know, when the patient gets truly unstable, that kind of goes out the window. Now, this patient wasn't truly unstable, but even aside from that, you know, it can often be really difficult to cardiovert AFib if the patient's been in it for a long time. And so you could also easily get into a situation when you're like, oh, there's no great drug to use. I just need to cardiovert. This patient doesn't look good. But you sedate to cardiovert with all the potential badness that can cause, and then it doesn't even work because she's been sitting in AFib for a long time, and it isn't that straightforward to give cardiovert. Now, she ended up giving diltiazem because she was like, I can't just let this rate stay in the 160s. That seems like a bad idea. This patient looks sick. We probably need to do something. But that caused the patient's blood pressure to drop quite substantially. So she was contacting me after the fact being like, do you have any other ideas of what I could have done in this really complicated situation? Because this is a really complicated situation. Because I agree, and you know, she certainly knew enough to know that neither DILT nor a beta blocker is ideal in a patient with acute decompensated pulmonary hypertension. This patient is almost certainly an RV failure, and it sounds like on the echo looked like they were in just florid RV failure. And giving this patient a beta blocker or calcium channel blocker is not a great plan, but you can't do amio because of the potassium. So what do you do? This is a time that I think you really need to take a step back and say, we got to think about de-stressing this patient. Because it didn't sound like this patient was like, oh, I went into AFib, then I suddenly became unstable. This is a patient with bad pulmonary hypertension, super volume overloaded, acute renal failure, super sick, and clearly under a great deal of physiologic stress. So this is when I think you really need to first line de-physiologic stress the patient, and then see, once you've done that, now what am I actually dealing with the AFib? So here's probably how I would have approached this patient. The first thing I would have done is gotten some vasopressin on board. Why? Well, for a patient with pulmonary hypertension, if their right-sided pressures are really high, you really got to be careful to support that MAP. Dropping the MAP can get you really in a great deal of trouble because that patient has high right-sided pressures because they're pushing against high pulmonary systolic pressures, right? And so their RV systolics are high. And high RV systolics put a lot of stress on the RV, but also can totally mess up your coronary perfusion pressure if you drop your MAPs. So, you know you're probably going to, for one reason or another, be doing stuff to this patient that could drop their pressures, right? Either you're sedating them to cardiovert them, or you're giving them drugs that may cause their pressures to drop. So I would start some vasopressin. And, you know, having MAPs in the 70s plus is probably not a terrible idea in this patient if you can get them, because then you're supporting their coronary confusion even in the situation of those really, really high RV systolic pressures. So I would start some vasopressin, maybe 0.04. The next thing I would do to help physiologically de-stress them is I want to help RV contractility, forward flow, right? Now, a good way to do this is probably not, in this case, to give them epi, right? They're in AFib with RVR at 160. So that is probably not the cleverest idea. And unfortunately, most things with inotropic activity also have chronotropic activity. Those two things are often married. And so how do I offload the RV and sort of support the RV without giving them a bunch of beta stimulation that could make the AFib worse? A great way to do that in that patient is an inhaled pulmonary vasodilator. Because since it's inhaled, it's not going to be causing a bunch of systemic effects. So if you happen to have Flolan or nitric or Veliti, any kind of inhaled epoprostenol or inhaled nitric oxide in your ED, fantastic. In most EDs, where you're asking yourself this question because it's the kind of ED that you don't have access to intensivist or cardiologists in-house, it's also probably the kind of place that you don't have access to inhaled nitric or inhaled epoprostenol, right? That's okay. For a long time, one of the places I worked didn't either. So what you do, if that is the case, you can do inhaled milrinone or inhaled nitroglycerin. I will point you guys in the direction of details on how to do that, but all it basically requires is getting either milrinone or nitroglycerin from the pharmacy, the stuff that you would normally use, and an albuterol mask, right? The same kind of mask you would use to nebulize albuterol. So I would start an inhaled pulmonary vasodilator. I don't have a lot of downside to doing that. Helps de-stress physiologically the RV without the downside of chronotropy. Now, the next thing I would do probably is I would start some Presidex. Increasingly, we're comfortable with starting this in the ED. And the nice thing about Presidex is a couple things. One, what's the major side effect of Presidex? bradycardia, which normally isn't helpful, except, oh wait, at this particular juncture, it actually is. Because what's our problem? AFib with RVR. And I found Precedex can be very helpful. Two, it de-stresses your patient in terms of their sympathetic drive. Because this patient, she's only 57. She probably has pretty solidly intact endogenous catechols, right? She's not 97, she's 57. And so she is anxious, she's probably a little agitated, she can't breathe. So her endogenous catecholamines are not really helping our AFib. And so giving her Precedex to chill her out a little bit will really help. And even on pretty high doses of Precedex, like 1.4, 1.5, I have guys in the ICU all the time. Patients who are elderly, hanging out on 1.5 of Precedex, they don't lose their airways. I'm trying to think of a time I've had somebody truly lose their airway on that much Precedex. It's very rare to the point of I can't even think of the time that happened. And I'm using it in, you know, sick, eld, complicated patients. So I would start some Precedex. But again, I already have my vasopressin on board to support the blood pressure before I'm starting the Precedex. Now, the other nice thing about Precedex, if things deteriorate and you really think this is the AFib, it's also a nice way to try to start sedating them for cardioversion. So I already have them on the Precedex. I already have that going. I'm starting to slowly sedate them. Then, if I get to the point where I'm like, no, we just need to cardiovert them and I need to sedate them further, I would max out my Precedex if it's not already maxed. Then I would probably add a little fentanyl. The thing I like about fentanyl in this situation are two things. One, it's short acting. Because if I give Versed and they're out and I cardiovert them and it works, great, but then they're out for, you know, the next long time with the Versed. If I give fentanyl, I have a lot less time that they're out after I cardiovert them. In addition, the reason I like fentanyl is that it's a great sympatholytic, right? Helps tamp down that sympathetic drive. I mean, that's why it often makes patients hypotensive when we give it, because it does tamp down that sympathetic drive. But in this particular situation, pre and post cardioversion, I don't want sympathetic drive too much because that's just going to make the AFib worse or could make them pop back into it because, you know what causes a lot of sympathetic activation? Getting shocked in the chest and not super comfortable. So if I had them to cardiovert, I would start giving sort of serial boluses of fentanyl till they'll chilled out enough to cardiovert. Now, I actually probably wouldn't cardiovert this patient yet, though. I would start the Precedex, have the fentanyl on standby. I probably wouldn't cardiovert them next. I probably would give them some magnesium. I mean, check their mag, but I target a mag of like 2.2 to 2.4 in these patients. Just give mag. There's not a lot of downside. Then I would start aggressive diuresis. And that's the other reason I would start the MAC, is I know I'm going to have to aggressively diurese this patient. One, it's going to help drop my potassium. It's going to correct my potassium. But two, the key thing I need to do to physiologically de-stress this patient is give them diuresis, right? I got to offload that right ventricle. I got to fix their volume status. Now, the upside of this is that once I aggressively diurese them, my potassium should correct. And once I have my potassium corrected and I know they're diuresing well, they're putting out good urine output, and I'm like, okay, they're going to keep putting out good urine, so I feel pretty good that my K is not going to go back to 7. Once I feel good about that and I recheck the K and my K is now 4, now I can give them amiodarone if my heart rate is still in the 160s and if I still think my AFib's an issue. So I would have amiodarone on standby and give it once my K is corrected. And when I mean aggressive diuresis, I don't mean like try 20 of Lasix and see what happens. This patient, her creatinine is high. She's going to require a big bolus of Lasix, not just because the creatinine's high, but also because she's not circulating very well, right? She's basically cardiogenic shock from RV failure. And so it's going to take a lot of Lasix. So I'm not going to be like, well, maybe do 20 IV and see what happens. No. One, you got to do it IV, not PO. Because especially with RV failure, her gut's going to be really edematous. PO is not really helping you. Two, dose. I'm giving like 80 IV now. You want her to pee like crazy to get off all that potassium, and she has a bunch of fluid to take off. So I'm giving like 80, maybe 100 of Lasix. And if that doesn't work, I'm not like, eh, it didn't work, maybe just call it a day. I'm escalating. How am I going to escalate? Well, I'll give a dose of Diaryl or metolazone with the Lasix. Ideally, you give it before, but, you know, just give it when you can. And then, in addition to that, I'll just start a drip. I'll start a Lasix drip, I'll start a Bumex drip, or redose the Lasix. And I'm escalating quickly. Because it's not going to get easier to diuresis, sir, right? The longer we wait, the worse the cardiogenic shock is going to get, the worse her forward flow is going to get, the harder it is going to be for her kidneys to respond. So I am escalating aggressively and rapidly in the ED. And then hopefully I can use some amio once the K is corrected. Now, if I do that and the K is corrected and the amio is not working and she's still 160, even once I feel like I've kind of fixed the physiologic stress, or at least I'm improving the physiologic stress, yeah, I would 100% do amio. I might also consider DIG. I've been using DIG more and more in sick patients recently. You have to be very careful with the renal failure. I wouldn't give a full load, but it's something else that you consider. Just keep in mind, it doesn't work right away. It can take hours. Last thing. If I'm really in trouble with this patient and they're not diuresing and I'm giving them massive amounts of Lasix, but their forward flow just isn't good enough, even though I have them on vaso, I have them on inhaled milrinone, the other thing I might consider is IV milrinone. If their pressure's stable on the vaso, the thing about milrinone is that it's really going to help their RV. It's going to help their pulmonary pressures. It's going to help their RV contractility. And compared to things like epi and dopamine and dobutamine, milrinone is going to be a lot less chronotropic. It's going to cause a lot less arrhythmias than your adrenergic agonists. And so if I really need to, I'll do that. And the way I think about it, it's kind of like the same reason that it's okay to give albuterol in an asthmatic who's really tacky. You're like, you know, okay, so the patient is tacky at 140 and they're having a really, really horrible asthma exacerbation, and you order a bunch of albuterol, and your respiratory therapist comes back to you and says, well, I can't give the albuterol because the patient's tacky to 140. What's the right answer? Well, the right answer there is, yeah, give the albuterol. Why? Well, because the patient is tachycardic. That asthmatic patient is tachycardic to 140 because they're physiologically stressed because they can't breathe. And so even though the albuterol will have a direct effect on causing more tachycardia, it'll have a much more significant effect in terms of its ability to physiologically de-stress the patient. And ultimately, that's really why they're tacky, is they're physiologically stressed because they can't breathe. So if I really need to in this patient, if I'm like, no, they're too physiologically stressed, they don't have good enough RV forward flow to circulate that Lasix and to get the fluid off, maybe I would give a little bit of milrinone, maybe start at 0.2, watch it carefully. So in sum, I think this case was really, really tricky. But I think, you know, the key thing for me for this case is to think about AFib with RVR. Is it really the primary cause of instability, which it could be at 160, but this patient has a lot of other stuff going on. So how do I physiologically de-stress these patients, preferably in ways that won't make the AFib worse, and then, when I can, deal with the AFib directly? So that is case number 2, complicated AFib. Thank you guys so much for listening.